What place does religion have in public schools? Today, we revisit our interview with two Illinois high school teachers who've developed new guidelines for teaching the subject.
Our goal is to try and help continue to inform our future citizens and to raise the level of conversation within our democracy so that we can have really important, respectful conversations about what matters most in a lot of people's lives.
Plus, with Halloween around the corner, we go back to our conversation about Illinois' history with ghost stories and why they're so popular to begin with.
The question can be answered in as simple a way as people love scary things, and in as complicated a way as, well, I want to see what's waiting for me on the other side. Is this proof of life after death?
But first, the University of Chicago's Polsky Center, we talked to them about their plans to build a new research facility on Chicago's south side and how the U of I is involved with it. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's a lot of innovation news happening in Illinois right now. Last Thursday, the governor and the University of Illinois announced plans for a new innovation hub and satellite campus in the South Loop. We talked about this on the program when we were joined by the University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen last week. Then, in addition to that, the U of I and the University of Chicago announced they're expanding their cross-state partnership that's been going on since 2014. As part of that expanded partnership, about 100 researchers, students, and faculty members from the U of I will now have access to another new complex in Hyde Park. That complex, which includes a 20-story tower and lab space, is being spearheaded by the University of Chicago's Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. To tell us more, we're joined now by John Flavin. He's Associate Vice President for Entrepreneurship and Innovation for the University of Chicago and head of the Polsky Center. Hi, John. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. How are you?
Good, thank you. Let's start by all of the news that was announced last week, because there was a flurry of a couple of different announcements. I want to just go big picture with you and ask you why you think it's so important to have collaboration between the University of Illinois and the University of Chicago, because oftentimes a lot of the universities in the state, frankly, are competing with each other.
Well, when you look at technological breakthroughs, the name of the game now is multidisciplinary collaboration. And in this case, being able to do that on a multi-institutional level allows for a greater rounding out of skills that are required to bring the next generation of new technologies to the marketplace. So in the case of the partnership between University of Chicago and the University of Illinois, the opportunity is to couple the collective strengths that we have in advanced analytics, kind of using data sciences, at the core, and then also material sciences. These are two areas of expertise that the universities share as strengths. By pooling our talents together and then offering an opportunity to translate those ideas into commercial opportunities, it's required that a co-location of those types of teams being together, coming up with these ideas and then turning them into business concepts and solutions for the marketplace are required.
And so you all have actually been doing this partnership since 2014. What specifically has come from the partnership that makes the investment, or I guess you should say the reinvestment that was announced last week, worth it? Can you give us some examples?
Absolutely. Our focus in the last couple of years has been really around innovation and entrepreneurship, coupling business school students at Booth with engineering students at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. As we know, each of these particular areas are strengths for the respective universities. And so the program that we did over the past couple of years was focused really around helping students convene and partner engineers with business capabilities and expertise in the Chicago and Urbana ecosystem. So we did a ton of programming, us going down to Urbana, working with engineering students and talking about the things we had going up on campus, bringing some of our Booth students down to campus, and then vice versa, bringing those teams up to Chicago. And that resulted in several hybrid teams that went on to compete in the respective business challenges. Down at U of I, it's the COSAD Business Challenge, and in Chicago, that's the New Venture Challenge within the Polsky Center. And coming out of those business plan competitions, there have been some companies that have emerged that have gone on to be very successful that have used these jointly talented teams, one being Explorer Medical that came out of the Medical Center here at the University of Chicago, where University of Illinois engineering talent developed some early prototypes. And then it has gone on to now just finished a Series A round, $3 million, where the University of Chicago's endowment was a co-investor. And then Tavala Foods, the microwave, the equivalent of the Keurig for cooking, is a joint team between Booth students as well as University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign nuclear engineer that have been very successful in getting funding and offering this translational technology to the marketplace very successfully.
And so that's an example of how you guys have started to work together. And it sounds like the physical location of you all being together is important. Can you tell us a little bit about the Polsky Center?
Well, the Polsky Center is focused on entrepreneurship and innovation across the university. And so it goes, you know, from the business school to the medical center to our biological sciences division. We connect all those pieces together and offer, on one end, education. So we teach entrepreneurship in the Booth School to venture creation and support within our Polsky Exchange. It's a 35,000-square-foot incubator on 53rd Street in Hyde Park, where we offer about 400 different workshops and events over the course of a year, and then co-working and incubator space for about 3,500 members. About 600 of those members come from outside the University of Chicago, and some from the surrounding neighborhood as well. And then lastly, we manage all of these ventures that could also involve intellectual property that arise from inventions from our faculty. So the Polsky Center operates and provides resources across all of these, from a fund that we invest in some of these ventures, to the workshops, to the curriculum. Our next extension then is adding space. So we announced a partnership with Wexford, a developer with expertise in working with universities to build innovation centers, to build a 280,000 square foot facility, which will consist of two buildings. One, a five-story wet laboratory facility. We don't have this type of space on the south side, and frankly, even in Chicago. And so we'll be able to offer startups that are developing technologies that need lab space, like new drugs or new diagnostics or new battery products, and then also a 20-story analytics tower, again, focusing on those two themes where the universities have strengths, analytics and material science. The analytics tower will bring joint teams together that are very interested in commercializing ideas that rely on the computing strengths between the University of Illinois and the University of Chicago. So it's a major expansion, and it will also offer additional space where larger companies can co-locate part of their teams, and other venture capital firms can locate their offices, because it's all about creating a self-sustaining ecosystem.
My guest is John Flavin. He's the Associate Vice President for Entrepreneurship and Innovation at the University of Chicago, and he's also head of the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. John, you mentioned a wet lab. What's that?
Well, when scientists are trying to develop a new technology, let's say a new drug, it involves chemistry. And so a wet lab consists of the kinds of laboratories that you're probably familiar with. If you took high school chemistry or high school physics or college for that matter, you know, you need the appropriate facility that has, you know, fume hoods with the proper ventilation, the appropriate types of instruments in place to be able to synthesize new compounds, test new materials. And ultimately, again, the major focus of this enterprise will be to take those early prototypes, prove them in concept, and then commercialize them. But a wet laboratory has unique infrastructure support that you find in other, you know, innovation ecosystems, such as in Boston and Cambridge and Kendall Square, where a lot of these types of facilities exist. But we don't have them in Chicago. And so it's really an additive piece of the entire ecosystem, both in Chicago and the state of Illinois.
So, John, as we're talking about this, we're talking about the Polsky Center, which already exists, and then this expansion, which you announced last week, which will include this construction and this wet lab. What's the timeline for that? What are we looking at?
Well, we're in the design phase right now. We expect to break ground in the first half of 2018 and be fully operational in the first part of 2020. So it's a pretty short time frame. We're moving very aggressively in the design phase right now, and we're accelerating down that pathway to be open in 2020.
And who is paying for all of this?
Well, it's a privately funded partnership with Wexford. We have struck that partnership, and they will be making a capital investment to build the buildings. And then the people that will work within the space will have operating costs that would exist, you know, with the programs that are currently part of the universities that are participating in this overall enterprise. So from a capital perspective, the financing is lined up through the developer to build the building, and then the teams that will come in and lease space, whether it be the outside market or the University of Chicago, will be supporting the investments in headcount and people to carry out the work that will be underway.
And why are you, I mean, I know that the University of Chicago has had some pretty incredible expansion throughout Hyde Park over the past couple of years. As we look at what the University of Chicago has done along the 53rd Street corridor, sort of expanding out into Hyde Park, do you think that it's also important for you to include sort of the Innovation Lab in that, along with the other buildings that are happening as the University of Chicago continues to sort of expand throughout Hyde Park?
Definitely. The 53rd Street corridor really has kind of become, you know, a live, work, and play environment, you know, over the course of the past 5 years, in addition to standing up and launching and accelerating the Polsky Exchange. The 35 new retail have come in. There's a hotel, the first hotel in Hyde Park in 50 years. And now along the same street, they're building a second boutique hotel. Whole Foods, 3 new residential complexes. So you get the picture. A lot of feet on the street, live, work, and play environment, very diverse community. And the vibrancy allows us to continue to build on what is required for an innovation center, where you're really producing great outputs. You rely on, you know, density and people being near each other to spark those ideas, to take those ideas and translate them. So, yes, it's quite intentional that we wanted to continue to deploy the appropriate infrastructure in and amongst this emerging and expanding innovation ecosystem within Hyde Park, which is a broader part of the overall Southside ecosystem that has a tremendous amount of capacity and upside potential over the course of the next several years. And we wanted to be a big part of helping to drive that.
And so I understand there's going to be, we've talked about U of C and U of I working inside this facility. Are there other groups or institutions that are going to be having a presence there? I understand the Army Research Lab will also be setting up shop.
Definitely. So the Army Research Laboratory selected a partnership with the University of Chicago as a gateway to partner with other research institutions in the region, including University of Illinois, in Urbana-Champaign, University of Illinois Chicago, Purdue, Northwestern, and others that have a joint research interest with the Army Research Laboratory. They're extending their Open Campus Initiative. They've done this with the University of Texas system down in Austin for ARL South and also ARL West out at USC and UCLA. So we are thrilled that they're locating ARL Central in Chicago, and even more importantly, within this, you know, vibrant innovation complex expansion that we've referred to here. What you're seeing here then is a public-private partnership where we're bringing in, you know, unique research enterprises, University of Chicago, University of Illinois. You know, we have affiliates like Argonne and Fermi that, you know, also have a joint interest in the kinds of things that we're doing, and we'll collaborate here. And then next thing you know, we're able to bring in other, you know, federal research labs that can bring in research dollars and collaborative opportunities like the Army Research Lab. We believe that that will then attract other regional research universities that need a footprint in the state of Illinois and in the Chicago ecosystem, and also larger companies that increasingly want to co-locate teams nearby the work that goes on in the areas that we're concentrating within, again, in analytics and material sciences to solve problems like in drugs like cancer and Alzheimer's to physical products like, you know, new materials, including next-generation batteries, et cetera. So that co-location is a key premise for the underlying premise for bringing this unique facility online. It's not really the building. It's about who's going to be there and how they're working collaboratively together in a multidisciplinary fashion to commercialize.
John, we just have about a minute left, but I wonder if briefly if you could just let us know about, you know, last week we spoke to University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen on the program about all of these announcements, the university and the governor announcing plans to establish a place in the South Loop, a satellite campus for the U of I. He talked about his motivation in part to be to retain top talent, to motivate high school students to stay in the state. What are your thoughts on being able to keep these students in state, as we know how many students are leaving Illinois? Some of our best and brightest students are not choosing universities here.
Well, it's a, again, very exciting, you know, push to build up more infrastructure in innovation, recognizing that the future economy will be built in these core pillars where the universities have strength and the region has strength. Again, picking these two underlying tools of analytics and materials that feed a diverse set of industries where the region has strength. So for us to be able to not just educate and create, you know, educate our students and create new ideas that get exported to the coast, we need to create the appropriate infrastructure. So the partnership, including these buildings, providing the right infrastructure, and most importantly, the right programming and connectivity to create companies that will hire students, will benefit from faculty research, and can incubate and grow here in Illinois, are critical components to how we then hold on to that talent that we help develop through our educational system here. And so it's imperative that job growth happens here so that when people start their career, they're able to have multiple jobs within the same ecosystem. And that's what's exciting about what's happening in Chicago and Illinois right now is by pushing around innovation and advancing these new technology translation and commercialization activities, we are increasing the odds that we'll be able to hold on to that talent that we are helping to train in a much more scalable fashion to have really strong, phenomenal impacts on the economy over time.
That's John Flavin. He's Associate Vice President for Entrepreneurship and Innovation at the University of Chicago. He's also head of the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. John, thanks for explaining all of that for us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When you think of religion in public schools, lots of people might think, ooh, these two don't mesh. But two Illinois teachers have been teaching religion courses at their public schools for years and say there's a huge need for this right now in high school curriculum. John Camardella teaches a world religions class at Prospect High School in Mount Prospect in Chicago's northwest suburbs. And Seth Brady teaches comparative religions, world culture, and sociology at Naperville Central High School in the southwest Chicago suburbs. Both of them were involved in writing up national guidelines that came out earlier this year about how to teach religion in a public school setting. And they're both joining me now. John, Seth, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having
us.
Yeah, Seth, let's start with you. You actually went to Prospect, where John now teaches, and you took a religion class back in high school. What do you remember from that class?
What I remember most is just how much it shifted my own worldview and helped me sort of understand the worldview of others.
And John, that class took a hiatus for several years, right, after that teacher left, but you started it back up 7 years ago. It's a year-long class. What's your approach?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, the class did go away for about 15 years, and I started it back up in 2009, and I teach two separate semesters. So if you take them combined, it's about a 40-week course. You know, and our approach is to take the first semester, and we spend about 3 weeks going through the different founding documents of the United States. We go through the First Amendment and the Establishment Clause. And then we move through most of the major religious traditions of the East. And then the second semester, we spend most of our time dealing with the Abrahamic traditions, as well as a unit on atheism, agnosticism, and humanism to support most of the Supreme Court rulings with regards to how to approach religion in an academic way.
Right, because if you're teaching, if you start with the government, those are sort of starting with our founding documents, obviously you're going to talk about the fact that we don't mix church and state. So how do you describe, first of all, how do you describe this class to people who are skeptical, and also how do you make sure you're satisfying those requirements?
Yeah, so like the big thing that we say right away is that we educate, we don't endorse. And so there's a real distinction between devotional expression of religion and the academic study, or what's known as religious study approach, where we teach about religion. And a lot of people don't think that that word about matters that much, but I would say it's one of the most important words when discussing how you approach religion in an academic way rather than a devotional way. So at no point do we, you know, move into that devotional expression of religion. It is a completely separate way of approaching, you know, the diverse religious landscape of our shared world.
And Seth, I imagine you have pretty strong feelings about why you think it's important that high school students are learning about religion right now.
Yeah, and I'll just echo what John mentioned, that, you know, we really have developed, both of us, a constitutionally appropriate non-devotional course, which I really see, and I'm sure John will agree, has an important civic purpose. It's important not only for students to understand these differing worldviews as an academic exercise, but also with the interest of knowing one's neighbors, both near and far.
John, are you using sort of current events also in your classroom to elaborate more on Seth's point? Is that something that comes up a lot?
It comes up all the time. And, you know, one of the core frameworks we use is the American Academy of Religion, which is the largest group of religious scholars in our country, put out back in 2010, you know, this idea, these three premises, that all religions are internally diverse, that they're culturally embedded, and that they change over time. They're not static. And so we approach each tradition through that lens. And so we try and combat and help people see that religious traditions are not uniform. You know, they are constantly evolving. They're very diverse. And it allows us the ability to try and teach how to approach the religious traditions. And at no point do we come across as experts in any way, shape, or form. It's much more about teaching the students how to approach the study of religion and culture rather than telling them this is, you know, a single monolithic way to approach what is in fact a very, very diverse tradition.
And Seth, I imagine to that John's point, you have a limited amount of time to cover a lot of material. So I wonder how you ensure that students understand the diversity of practices and beliefs that can exist even within individual religions.
Yeah, and I would agree that you know, that approach of really guiding or organizing the class along those three principles is what I do in my class as well, and really try to think about religions in terms of what John and I and our colleagues refer to as the three B's, which is belief, behavior, and belonging, as sort of the core of religious identities. So religions are not only about what people believe, but what they do and how they interact as communities, and sort of the interplay between those three B's. To, you know, think about how that's structured in a course, you know, we start out with sort of, you know, the view from maybe 40,000 feet talking about beliefs and behaviors, and then really try to zero in on, you know, one or two, or as many as we can fit, depending on the unit, individual religious communities, so they get an in-depth sense of really how that community functions and how it relates to sort of that broader view of the tradition kind of written large.
I wonder for both of you, Seth, I wonder if you can start, and John, if you can chime in. What kind of conceptions or questions do your students come in with? Do you find that in particular there are a lot of misconceptions, Seth?
Definitely misconceptions. I would say, though, that really, for the most part, both of our classes are elective courses. So they're interested. They want to know. They realize this is a gap in their learning. And they might not say express it in these terms, but it's really a gap in their sort of citizenship education that, for example, you might have two very good friends who have known each other for multiple years. They're two different religions, but have left it completely untouched and know nothing about that aspect of one another's lives. And this course really gives students an excuse to get to know their neighbors and, in some cases, friends, to really drill down and understand a person's perspective. So it really opens up a space for that. And, you know, I want to add, too, that the framework that was developed to guide teachers in teaching religions isn't just for courses like John and mine, where it's a, you know, standalone dedicated course. It's probably more so for courses like world history or geography or sociology, where there's sort of natural intersection points of the curriculum with religion. And so to equip teachers not only with the framework that helps them understand what is and isn't constitutionally appropriate in terms of teaching, but also provide them with a framework to teach and investigate these religions in a way that's going to be fruitful not only for understanding the religion on its own terms, but shed light on the subject of study. So the culture they're studying, whether it's past or present, or perhaps the literary work they're investigating.
Both of you have mentioned constitutionally appropriate. And John, I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, you and Seth helped write these national guidelines for the National Council for Social Studies. Can you explain, give us a sense, maybe a bird's eye view of what's constitutionally appropriate? I mean, you've mentioned some things, right, that obviously this is an academic setting, you're teaching about religions. What other advice do you have for teachers? What's in these guidelines?
Yeah, so I think the big thing always for me, and this is my personal way of approaching it, is you go back to the Establishment Clause, and we really break it down to really four words, right? There's no establishment of religion. And yet there must be free exercise. And so we really spend quite a few days, and I have the luxury of it because, you know, Seth and I both do, because we teach standalone courses. But any teacher across the state and across the country can help their students become a more informed citizen by understanding that, you know, Seth and I directly are agents of the government. And so thus, because we are agents of the government, we cannot endorse a particular point of view. And so we also use the Supreme Court case Abington versus Shemp. And to put a quick summary on it, it's just that the government cannot, you know, endorse one religion or one religious view over another. And it also cannot, you know, elevate belief over non-belief or vice versa. And so that would be a great place to start. And it's where I start with my students every year about really laying out the rules for how we engage in class and giving them the confidence to begin asking really important questions, you know, critical questions, respectful questions, but questions that do lead them to a deeper understanding of those three premises. And I'll return to again that all religions are internally diverse, that they're situated in the cultures in which they're practiced, and that they're dynamic, that they change. And what we hope to do sometimes, and you had mentioned a little bit ago that, you know, what do students ask? Or, you know, many students come in really well-meaning and with honest questions and honest concerns. And something that we try and help them with is to disrupt some of the assumptions that they might have. And if we're learning anything, you know, and if our lessons and, you know, the materials we use are worthwhile, it will shake things up a little bit. It should disrupt assumptions. You know, we're not there to reinforce what might be a singular worldview. We're here to bring in a diversity of opinions to try and help elevate the conversation.
It sounds like both of you were saying that you almost feel like, in a way, and I would agree with you, that religion is almost, especially with young people, but with everyone really, is a little bit of a taboo. People are either don't want it to the people. Maybe I think a lot of people maybe are embarrassed or they don't know and they don't want to seem ignorant. How much of that do you think is really a gap in civic society right now? As you're saying, in public schools, you really feel like that needs to be overcome.
If I were to just quickly respond to that, is I think what makes people nervous or why it's talked about in different ways that would often be deemed as disrespectful, is that I think a lot of people are lacking the language with regards to how to engage in these types of conversations. You know, for example, the difference between a devotional assertion and an academic concept, they're two very different things. You know, if you're making a theological assertion about being a practitioner of religion, that's one thing, but to talk about religion from an academic standpoint, that's something else. And so what our courses do and what these new national guidelines we hope do is to give people the language to know how to speak about religion. And when they hear religion spoken about in certain ways, that they know how to compartmentalize it so they understand whether or not it's a devotional theological assertion or if it's an academic discussion about that said tradition or traditions.
Well, and also, as you said, to your point, also people who don't have religious beliefs. That's also part of what you all are discussing as well.
Correct.
So I guess my last question to you is just for both of you, especially at this moment when we're having so much public discussion, I guess in our civic life or in the media about different religions, about the way we're interacting with each other. I wonder for you what advice you have for other teachers out there, other families, parents, people who are interacting with young people about how they should be approaching this. Seth, let's start with you.
You know, I think one of the ways that we got to where we are now, if you look at how the First Amendment is structured with the free exercise and establishment clauses, it really set up a situation where individual traditions and people practiced independently. And it was sort of a, you know, you do what you do, I'll do what I do, or perhaps non-religious added to that as well. And we'll never discuss and we'll never dialogue. We'll just keep it in this essentially a separate space from one another. And I think part of that lack of communication that emerged from that is a contributing factor to what we see now. You know, I think for my advice for teachers, if I had one piece of advice to give, it would be to look up the AAR guidelines for teaching about religion in public schools and to take a look at the new National Council for Social Studies guidelines, because it really does set out very clearly the constitutionality of teaching about religion in public schools. But I think equally important, provides insight and guidance on exactly how to do that, how to approach it. And I think in reading that, a teacher becomes a much better, has an improved ability to navigate what sometimes is difficult terrain in some of these difficult conversations that intersect with religion.
John, we're almost out of time. I just wonder if you have any final thoughts as well.
Yeah. No, I'll tell just a quick story about how I first came to the understanding of religious literacy. As I remember being at a conference with the Archbishop of South Africa, Desmond Tutu, and he was talking about the real problem of religious illiteracy, where so many people are trying to say that religious traditions are wholly positive or wholly negative, and neither of those are correct. You know, Desmond Tutu gave the analogy that religion is like a knife on a table, that how you use the knife is what gives it its quality. And in that way, how religion is used is the way in which it's going to be perceived. And so to present religious traditions as wholly positive or wholly negative is to do a disservice. And so through these religious studies guidelines and through our work, our goal is to try and help continue to inform our future citizens and to, you know, raise the level of conversation within our democracy so that we can have really important, respectful conversations about what matters most in a lot of people's lives.
That's John Camardella. He teaches world religions at Prospect High School in Mount Prospect in Chicago's northwest suburbs. I want to thank Seth Brady as well. He's at Naperville Central High School in the southwest suburbs of Chicago. Both of them involved in writing these national guidelines that came out earlier this year. We'll have more information about that at our website at 21stshow.org. John, Seth, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a real thrill.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's Halloween soon, so we thought we would talk ghost stories for a minute, or to be more specific, Illinois haunted place stories. We're joined on the line by authors Colin Dickey and Troy Taylor, who've both written about haunted places in Illinois and other states around the country. Troy has written a handful of books on haunted places in Illinois, including Haunted Illinois Ghosts and Strange Phenomena of the Prairie State. Colin, Troy, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us on.
Troy, let's start with you. You started getting interested in ghost stories at a pretty young age. What initially sparked your interest?
Actually, it was a record. a record on the back of a honeycomb cereal box. When I was about 10 years old, they put out ghost stories one year, and you could cut it off and play it on your record player. And I had three different stories, but the one that really stuck with me was the Vanishing Hitchhiker story, which I played over and over again in my parents' basement until it wore out, which didn't take much because it was the back of a cardboard box. It did stick with me, and I think that that's just kind of what kicked off my interest in, you know, ghosts and all kinds of strange things, and that's all I've ever done my whole life. So I guess that record started all of it for me.
And as it turns out, that record and that story about the Vanishing Hitchhiker, I know that's really, some would say, eerily similar to one of your favorite ghost stories in Illinois, the Resurrection Mary story. Can you tell us that story?
You know, what makes it so unique is that it's not just a resurrection or just a Vanishing Hitchhiker story, because her legend is really been created from real places and real events and real people. Not only was she a real person, actually two young women, but she was encountered by real people, including a number who, to the day they died, swear that they spent the entire night with her. I mean, the basic story is that she is a young woman who hitches rides on Archer Avenue on the southwest side of Chicago, trying to get to the Willowbrook, or from the Willowbrook Ballroom, which was a dance hall, to Resurrection Cemetery. And people who have had her in the car claim that she disappears at the gates. And there have been maybe 100 or more people who claim they've encountered her. Some of them are really convincing. A man named Jerry Palis, I interviewed before he passed away in the early 90s. And he, you know, he swore to me that one night in the late 40s, he had picked her up and had given her a ride. She'd gotten out of the car, ran across the road, and vanished at the cemetery gate. So, you know, it's a classic Vanishing Hitchhiker story, but it's just one of those stories that really grabbed my attention at a young age, and I've always been fascinated with it.
So, Colin, your book is called Ghostland, American History in Haunted Places. And I have to ask, how does Illinois rank in terms of when you look across the country and all of the places you covered? Where are we in terms of how many haunted places we have?
Illinois turns out to be pretty good. You know, I wanted to kind of sample, you know, ghost stories and kind of, in some cases, the true stories behind them, you know, all around the country. And sure enough, you find a lot of great stuff in the South in particular. You find a lot of stuff in New England. But Illinois is doing just well. I mean, I think there are some really great stories that are associated in and around Chicago, particularly amongst its cemeteries, and then stories, you know, related to the 1893 fire, of course, and also out in sort of, you know, farther places. One of the places I looked at was a house in Bull Valley, Illinois. It is famous for supposedly being haunted and being built by spiritualists out there.
Right. And that's in northern Illinois. And your book is about how you analyze how they were created through the years. Can you tell us about how that story actually started? Because in your book, you talk about a design flaw that was in the house.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really curious and beautiful house. It's now, I think, being used by the sheriff, but it doesn't, the walls are, or the corners are rounded. So it built to sort of look like a sort of rounded Italian villa. And, you know, and the guy who designed it, I think, just designed it that way aesthetically. But over the years, it got associated with another idea that that the sort of folklore idea that the devil will catch you in corners. And so if you want to keep away from the devil, the way to do it would be to build round rooms and round houses. And so over time, these two stories kind of merged, and the idea evolved that this house was actually built to keep away the spirits from catching the builder of this house. And, you know, and mysteriously, he finally was found dead in the one corner in the entire house, which is kind of fictitious, but, you know, kind of suggests the way that sometimes a strange or unusual building will kind of gather up ghost stories to it in unusual and surprising ways.
Colin, is it sometimes strange to learn the actual history of how these stories started?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of cases, I started looking at these places sort of assuming that the stories were true, and, you know, and it was kind of a bummer in some cases to learn how they had been sort of fabricated over the years. But I think what I tried to do in the book as a whole, and what I ultimately found even more fascinating, is trying to figure out how these stories evolved over the years, why some stories get told and retold more than others, and what maybe that says about us psychologically and culturally, that we favor certain kind of stories over others.
Troy, what do you think? I mean, I'm thinking back to your hitchhiker story, and you're telling me about all of the people, hundreds of people who, in this case, 100 people who saw this same woman. What's it like to talk to someone who's so convinced that they've experienced something like this?
You know, that's one of the things that I can think has kept me interested in this for the last 25 years or so, is because I've talked to so many people who have such a fascination. And one of the things, and I'm going to throw this in there, but because I really liked Colin's book, it's very good. And one of the things that I've noticed about it and loved about it was the fact that these stories do get started and change and merge into other things often, but oftentimes they do get started for a very good reason. The story may change and twist and turn over the years, but I think a lot of times, at least in some of the research I've done, that people who have encountered something are so convinced by what it was that, you know, they don't want to let it go. I mean, we don't know why people are so fascinated with ghosts. I mean, I think the question can be answered in as simple a way as people love scary things, and in as complicated a way as, well, I want to see what's waiting for me on the other side. Is this proof of life after death? And I think that's what keeps a lot of belief for a lot of people, is that they're sure they encountered something, and maybe it was, you know, the ghost of Resurrection Mary, or maybe it was something else entirely, but they're so convinced and so deepen their beliefs because we're all wanting to know what comes next.
Colin, we mentioned Bull Valley in northern Illinois. Troy, you talked about Resurrection Mary and that story on the south side of Chicago, well, a little further south of the city also, it sounded like. Troy, what are some other spots that you think of when you think of sort of top haunted spots in Illinois?
Well, some of my favorite spots, there's the Lincoln Theater in Decatur, Illinois, is an old vaudeville theater, just turned 100 years old, I think, yesterday. And it's one of those places where, you know, people have come for years and claim that they've had encounters with something spectral inside the building. There's a church down in Alton, Illinois, that's haunted.
Sorry, where did you say, sorry?
In Alton,
Illinois, okay.
Down along
mm-hmm.
the Mississippi, yeah, and it's not. I mean, Alton's one of those towns that's got this great history of all this Civil War history, these horrific things that have happened there over the years. But there's this one building that I consider to be the most haunted building in town, and it's a minister actually committed suicide in 1936 in the building, and you know, the parishioners have believed that he's never left, that
wow.
his ghost has been there all along.
Okay, so you give tours, right? You give tours at the Lincoln Theater, and you have an Alton as well.
Yeah, I've got tours all over the state.
And what do you do? How do you do that? Do you go in? Do you tell the story? What happens?
Well, all of the tours are usually based on history. And they're history tours that have ghost stories attached to them, because history is the most important thing to me. I mean, that's the, I think, reason why I've stayed with this as long as I have, because I think that most supernatural events that people report or encounter, I think, can be explained by history. I think that events especially traumatic or violent events, sort of leave an impression behind on a place. I guess just sort of a lingering bit of history that, you know, we think of it as a haunting, you know, sights, sounds, things that people can't explain. And you know, if you're in the right place at the right time, well, maybe you'll experience it yourself. And that's kind of the idea behind the tours, is to take people to places where there's a great history behind it. And there are ghost stories attached to it, too. We don't ever tell people that we're going to take them to some place and we guarantee that ghosts are going to, you know, come out and perform on command or anything.
Right.
Like
you guys
that.
Are not it's ghost not, hunters. This is not sci-fi ghost hunters, right? You're not going in there with instruments and measuring things.
Right. No. And yeah, that kind of thing has not really ever interested me that much. I don't know how you would ever really prove anything.
Yeah. Colin, how about you? That's not something I imagine. It doesn't sound like that's something you do either, right?
You know, I did it a couple of times for the book. I went to the Lemp Mansion in St. Louis, Missouri, and took a ghost tour involving a infrared camera looking for spirits. And yeah, the results were inconclusive, but you know, I think it is a kind of, you know, it's another sort of fascinating way to kind of try to reach out and touch something maybe a little larger than yourself. And I think that can be kind of fascinating in its own right, even if occasionally it's a little hokey.
Well, and let me ask you guys both of this. Is we have a couple minutes to wrap up, but I think this is kind of the important last question for both of you, right? And Colin, let's start with you. I think some people love visiting haunted places, especially this time of year. Others would prefer to not entertain the idea that ghosts may be real. And I'm wondering where each of you stand personally about what you believe about this. Colin?
You know, I think that you know, we're kind of told that there are kind of two different answers to that question, that either you are a 100% believer in ghosts or you are a 100% skeptic, rational person. And when I was interviewing people and talking to people about ghosts, what I found again and again is that most of us are somewhere in between, and I guess I'd put myself in that category. I mean, I met so many people who, you know, they don't believe in ghosts, but they've seen something they can't explain, or, you know, or maybe they do, but they've found a way to explain away everything they've ever possibly seen. And I think that's kind of a more interesting place to be, in that kind of ambiguous sort of middle ground.
Troy, what about you?
Well, I mean, I can tell you that I, for me personally, and this is just my personal belief, I believe there's something after this, not necessarily in a religious sense, but maybe in a spiritual one. And I do believe in ghosts just because of some of the personal experiences I've had. Now, I don't go around trying to convince other people they need to believe. And I believe that most hauntings are just like what I described, just sort of a lingering history. But I do think that there are cases out there where there are spirits who their personality stays behind for whatever reason. And I've had enough experiences in doing this for, you know, 25 years that I feel like that's something that has convinced me. But most of the time I'd have to agree with Colin and call myself optimistically skeptical. I go to places where I'd like to believe it's haunted, but, you know, oftentimes, you know, with the stories or the, you know, the facts, you don't really necessarily mean much of anything. They don't agree with the stories or whatever. So it's just, I think of it as a lot of fun, and I'm lucky to get to do what I do.
And so that said, that said, what's the strangest phenomenon you've ever encountered, Troy, here in Illinois?
Well, I mean, I went to a woman's house. This has been years ago. And to keep the story short, she claimed that all of these things were happening, that there were, you know, things moving around and there were footsteps and noises and everything. And this is before I stopped going to people's houses because I found that the living are much scarier than the dead. But in this particular case, I will tell you that we were all sitting in the living room and actually heard someone running back and forth. I mean, running, pounding back and forth in the hallway upstairs. They were so afraid of the upstairs that they kept it locked. They didn't even go up there. There was so much noise. So we unlocked the door. I ran up there. I searched the floor. There's absolutely no one there. And I can't explain it. Couldn't explain it then. Can't explain it now. But it was unnerving, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think you've unnerved all of us now. All right, that's Troy Taylor. He's the author of Haunted Illinois, Ghosts and Strange Phenomena of the Prairie State, as you heard. He gives lots of tours throughout Illinois. I want to thank also Colin Dickey. His book is called Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate you sharing your stories.
Absolutely. Thanks.
We're out of time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. We're produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montecilio, and Bob Hawley. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're broadcasting today from the McGill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.